Some of you have mentioned problems with line numbering. Let me just quickly talk about line numbering in Shakespeare texts. I doubt if any two editions are exactly the same. Problem being twofold. Some editions don't have room to print out the full line and thus take the end and put it down below, and some of them count that as another line. Also, when you come to prose passages, which don't have deliberate lineation, depending on the amount of space they have, they'll break it at various places. So in one text, you may have 5 lines of prose, in another text, 10 or 15 lines of prose, and they count each line. So when I give a line number, it's an approximation. Go searching for it somewhere in that vicinity. It's not easy, but you're bright. You can find it. Let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this hour and I'm going to try to get through the rest of Act One. This means I'm not going to be able to finish Othello tomorrow, so we may have to steal some time elsewhere and do more Othello, which is fine by me. And part of what I want to do this afternoon, so you can put some questions in your brains, I'd like to take some time just to talk about Shakespeare. Okay, I mean this is a figure who looms. So if you've got questions just overall about Shakespeare this afternoon, I'd like to address some of that. And he plays a very important role right now. There is a reason why an attempt is being made to get him out of the classroom. More and more universities are dropping Shakespeare as a requirement, even for English majors. They are now corrupting the text. They're Chaucerizing him. They're doing modern updates, modern rewrites. You kill the language, you kill the poetry, you're killing Shakespeare. He'll be gone. He will be they're trying to make him as little read as Chaucer. There's a battle on. You need to be aware of it. But we'll talk more about this afternoon. But my point is, I've just covered Act One of Othello this morning. Don't feel we have to stick to that this afternoon. So feel free to come with whatever questions you've got. Let's go into Scene Two. We're in Venice. We're on a street. And again, this is deliberate. We've moved to a different section of the city. We're in the city. Iago begins the scene again. We have a second conversation between Iago and another man. This time it's Iago and Othello. Please notice we begin with another bald-faced lie. Though in the trade of war I have slain men, yet do I hold it very stuff of the conscience to do no contrived murder. I lack iniquity sometime to do me service. 9 or 10 times I had thought to have yerked him here under the ribs. He's telling about seeing Brabantio. Brabantio's found out his daughter has eloped. And he says, you know, I've been in the wars, I can murder men, but sometimes I'm just not mean enough. Sometimes I just don't have it in me to kill. 9 or 10 times I would have taken my sword and just thrust it into his ribs, but, I couldn't do it. By the way, remember this little speech when you come to read the end of the play. Othello's first words in the play. We finally meet our hero. Half a line, 'tis better as it is. It's a good thing you didn't do that. Leave well enough alone. Let things take their own course. The first words of Othello are ironic, because what has caused the problem is specifically the hero did not allow things to take their own course. He did not think it was better as it was. He has, if you will, himself subverted the order of Venice. We're going to find out about that very soon. It's going to occupy most of the rest of this act, okay? Iago says, he's angry. Her father's angry. He's going to try to get you divorced. He's going to try to break this up. He won't let this stand. Othello, second speech in the scene. Let him do his spite. My services which I have done the signori shall out-tongue his complaints. First cause of hope. I have done good service to Venice. They need me. The city's need of me is greater than any personal problem of Duke Brabantio. Now, let me just clarify this. It becomes clear later on. Othello is a mercenary. He's a hired soldier. And we're going to find out in scene two, Venice is in the midst of a war. We have internal disruption. There is external disruption. The Turks are fighting with Venice. We have the super civilized state, and the very word in Renaissance England would have meant the barbarians. We have the external barbarians who are fighting the civilized state. What the state has done because, and it's fascinating, why does a state hire mercenaries? Venice was very rich. Venice had a good population. Okay. Venice may be too civilized to fight. There is the assumption here that perhaps one of the dangers of civilization is that when the time comes you're at war, you have to go hire people to fight because you can't count on your own people who have become too civilized, too citified, too content. In the same way that if we have a city-state that has become all manners, all charm, all trimmings, how do you tell who's an Iago and who's not? If we have the place that has such magnificent externals, how do you know what's behind the externals? How do you know what's in the interior? It's a real problem. Othello has come to fight for Venice. He is a mercenary. He's a great soldier. We'll get his story in a moment. So the first thing is, they need me. They brought me here. They need me. 'Tis yet to know which when I know that boasting is an honor, I shall promulgate. When the time comes and I can boast about myself, then they'll find out I fetch my life and being from men of royal siege. I come from royal background, he says. I'm not a commoner. I come from royalty. And my demerits may speak unbonneted to as proud a fortune as this that I have reached. I am worthy of his daughter. For know, Iago, but that I love the gentle Desdemona, I would not my unhoused free condition put into circumscription and confined for the sea's worth. I am a free man. I have roamed about the world. I am a soldier. I am a traveler. And the only reason I have agreed to the bond of marriage is because I love this woman. And soon everyone will find out I too am of royal birth and therefore I am worthy of her. We've got a problem here. If that's the case, why didn't you go tell her father? If that's the case, why didn't you ask for his permission for his daughter's hand in marriage? He has come. He's a soldier of Venice. We learn he is converted to Christianity. He is a nobleman. Then what's the problem? The problem is he's the Moor of Venice. He's black. He's different. He may be among them, but he's not of them. He's an outsider. He knows it. He knows it. In they come, okay, they're looking for him. He thinks at first it's because of the disruption, Brabantio's anger, and it turns out, no, the Senate is meeting in the middle of the night and called him at once. There's trouble elsewhere. But before we get to that, in comes Brabantio, okay? Now, I want to read just the beginning of Brabantio's accusation. In comes Brabantio with his men. Othello and Iago are there with others of their soldiery, including Cassio, who will become increasingly important. They all draw swords. And as soon as the swords are drawn and there's about to be bloodshed on the streets of Venice, it is stopped by Othello. It's a great line. Keep up your bright swords. for the dew will rust them. Don't draw your swords out. It's morning time. You're going to get dew all over your swords and they will rust. It's a wonderful line. Keep up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them. But of course, we've got another little hint there. We encounter the hero at night, swords are drawn, and the order is given, put away your swords. For he who lives by the sword shall die by the sword. And again, that echo is resounding through the play, and we get that little echo to make clear we are beginning with a heroic figure here. We are beginning with a man who has indeed converted. He obviously knows the scriptural passage, and he's using it. There will not be battle on the streets of Venice, he is saying. The mercenary, the soldier, is the peacekeeper. We are beginning with a heroic man. And it is important that he be established as a hero. Keep up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them. Good signor, you shall more command with years than with your weapons, he says to his now father-in-law, who's not happy having assumed that title. O thou foul thief, where hast thou stowed my daughter? Damned as thou art, thou hast enchanted her. For I'll refer me to all things of sense. If she in chains of magic were not bound, whether a maid so tender, fair, and happy, so opposite to marriage, that she shunned the wealthy, curled darlings of our nation, would ever have to incur a general mock, run from her guardage to the sooty bosom of a such a thing as thou, to fear, not to delight. She turned down all these good young men of Venice who came, and now she's run off and married you? You must have worked magic on her. Well, wait a minute. Once again, it's Shakespeare, and there are clues in the language. Look at the description of the young men of Venice. The wealthy, curled darlings of our nation. Now we know why they have to hire mercenaries, right? The city is super civilized. We got lots of money. We're out, you know, we're going to the Gap every night and buying the best threads, okay? And we're going to the his, her hair cuttery, and we're getting our hair done just right, and it's being cut this way, and I want some little curls here, okay? Darlings of our nation? These are the Venetians who have come wooing Desdemona? Well, we haven't met her yet, but we know one thing. She's got to be a real woman. Because she looked at these guys and said what? No, thank you. No, I'm not going to marry anyone whose hair is better curled than mine. But the vision of Venice, and this is a real danger, is that there is the danger for civilization to become over-civilized, hyper-civilized. At which point, you don't have fighting men, and you don't have husbands. You've got wealthy, curled darlings. And suddenly, notice again, what we should be seeing in the first act, we're getting some clarification. Now, he may be a Moor, he may be black, but he's a man. He is manly. He's been a soldier. He's been out and fought. And you can rest assured, you know, he's not wearing the best garments, and his hair isn't, well, you know. This is a soldier. This is a man. And she has chosen that, okay? But before the battle is enjoined, we're off to the council. The Senate is meeting. Boom, we're into scene three. I'm leaping ahead. It's going to take me a while to get through scene three. And what do we find out? The Turks are attacking. Now, please notice. We began with disorder in the house. The daughter escaped from the house and married without her father's knowledge. Scene one. Scene two, there's disorder in the streets. We have the father encountering the son-in-law. Swords are drawn. There's about to be blood spilled in the streets of Venice. The argument has broken out of the house and spilled onto the streets. Now we're in the Senate council chamber and the Turks are attacking from outside. Act one of Othello is a world at war on every level. Domestic in the house, on the streets among the citizens, and outside, the enemy, the barbarian, is coming. It's war everywhere. And therefore, Venice needs the great soldier. Venice needs Othello. And it's looking bleak because the Turks are making for the Isle of Cyprus, a stepping stone to get to Venice. Okay? We got to stop them there or they're going to be at our gates. We all come into the Senate, however, they all arrive, and the Duke, before he can talk politics, before we can get into the business of war, is interrupted by Brabantio, who is a senator, who says, "My daughter, oh my daughter," I'm in Act 1, Scene 3, line about 55. He is weeping and saying, "My daughter," and the senators say, quite rightly, "Dead? Desdemona has died?" His response, "Aye to me. She is abused, stolen from me, and corrupted by spells and medicines bought of mountebanks. For nature so preposterously to err, being not deficient, blind, or lame of sense, sans witchcraft could not." This defies nature. This defies reason. Okay? "She's dead to me. I've lost my daughter." Notice the Duke's response. We're Duke of Venice here. "Whoe'er he be, that in this foul proceeding hath thus beguiled your daughter of herself, and you of her, the bloody book of law you shall yourself read in the bitter letter after your own sense. Yea, though our proper son stood in your action. Whoever did this, we'll throw the book at him. Even if it was my own son," says the Duke, "I'd throw the book at him. Who was it?" Brabantio says, "Humbly I thank your grace, here is the man, this Moor, whom now it seems your special mandate for the state affairs hath hither brought." It's this guy you need to save the city. Boom. It's a wonderful moment. All the senators say, "We are very sorry for it. Oh, too bad. Oh, so it's this guy who's going to defend my life and home and property in the city where I live. Oh, well." And the Duke says, "What in your part can you say to this?" He says to Othello, "You say something. I can't say anything." Okay? Brabantio, "Nothing but this is so." The only thing he can say is that he did it. Now, watch this. What we get to the first great speech of Othello. We're talking heroics. But beyond that, we're talking a Moor, we're talking someone from those African countries who is other than he seems. Wait a minute. The exterior, the black warrior, and suddenly from his mouth comes this speech. "Most potent, grave, and reverend signors, my very noble and approved good masters, that I have ta'en away this old man's daughter, it is most true. True I have married her. The very head and front of my offending hath this extent, no more. Rude am I in my speech." It's a rhetorical device. He says, as he's making one of the great speeches anybody ever made, "Rude am I in my speech, and little blessed with the soft phrase of peace. For since these arms of mine had 7 years' pith, till now some 9 moons wasted, they have used their dearest action in the tented field. And little of this great world can I speak, more than pertains to feats of broils and battle. And therefore little shall I grace my cause in speaking for myself. Yet by your gracious patience I will a round unvarnished tale deliver of my whole course of love, what drugs, what charms, what conjuration, and what mighty magic, for such proceeding I am charged withal, I won his daughter." That's the introduction. He's saying, I'll tell you, I don't speak well, I've only known action in the field, I'm rude of speech, but I'll tell you everything I used to win her. I just reduced it to modern colloquialism. The language is magnificent. If you hear those stately rhythms in those words, you're already getting a sense of the magnificence of this man. Shakespeare creates his characters through their language. And in order to understand Shakespeare's characters, you've got to look closely at the language. Now, before he continues, they send for Desdemona. She's going to come, and in between times, he's going to, okay, line, I'm at about 125, until she come as truly as to heaven, I do confess the vices of my blood. Please notice, what is he emphasizing? I'm a Christian. I will tell you my vices as truly as I confess to heaven my vices. He's saying, I go to confession. I've become a Venetian. I am a Christian. So justly to your grave ears I'll present how I did thrive in this fair lady's love and she in mine. Say it, Othello. Her father loved me, oft invited me. Wait a minute, where are we putting the blame? Hey, he's the one who invited me. And he invited me often. Still questioned me the story of my life from year to year. The battle, sieges, fortune that I have passed. I ran it through, even from my boyish days, to the very moment that he bade me tell it, wherein I spoke of most disastrous chances, of moving accidents by flood and field, of hairbreadth scapes in the imminent deadly breach, of being taken by the insolent foe and sold to slavery, of my redemption thence, and portents in my travels history, wherein of antres vast and deserts idle, rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven, it was my hint to speak. I just want to look at that one line for an instant. I'm going out of character for an instant just to look at the poetry. Rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven. Hear it? We start with a verbal description of the rock, the hardness. You can hear it in the sounds of the words. Rough quarries, rocks. Hear it? The words are sounding like what they're talking about. That's great poetry. And then, and hills whose heads touch heaven. Hear it? We're going up and down the hills. We've got those H sounds that begin it. And as we go through, we go from the short I sound of hills to head to heaven, and the vowels get drawn out, and we're climbing those hills and going higher. I mean, it's just, if he had written that one line, he would have been a great poet. Rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven. It's a throwaway in the middle of the speech. It was my hint to speak. Such was my process. And of the cannibals that each other eat, the anthropophagi, and men whose heads grew beneath their shoulders. He's been in uncivilized lands. He's spent time with the cannibals. He's seen the anthropophagi, you know, legendary creatures whose heads grow, you know. I've seen it all, he says. And I would come and her father would want to hear what? Tell me more stories. Tell me more cannibal stories. What does the civilized senator in Venice want to hear about the uncivilized world? Fascination with it. These things to hear would Desdemona seriously incline. It's more interesting than the wealthy curly darlings. But still the house affairs would draw her thence. Whichever as she could with haste dispatch, she'd come again and with a greedy ear devour up my discourse. He's talking to the father. The daughter's listening. She has to go off and do things around the house, but then she's back. And notice, it's an image of appetite. And with a greedy ear, devour up my discourse. Appetite is being created by listening to the stories of a real man who's been a hero out in the world, which I, observing, took once a pliant hour and found good means to draw from her a prayer of earnest heart that I would all my pilgrimage dilate, whereof by parcel she had something heard, but not intentively. I promised to tell her the whole story that she'd only heard little bits of. I did consent and often did beguile her of her tears when I did speak of some distressful stroke that my youth suffered. He would tell her about being a young man out in the world and the battles he went through and the suffering he went through. And she, being a good woman, wept at it. My story being done, she gave me for my pains a world of kisses. She swore in faith 'twas strange, 'twas passing strange, 'twas pitiful, 'twas wondrous pitiful. She wished she had not heard it, yet she wished that heaven had made her such a man. Oh, I wish I'd never heard it, but I wish there was a man like that around for me. She thanked me and bade me, if I had a friend that loved her, I should but teach him how to tell my story, and that would woo her. Upon this hint, I spake. Who initiates the romance? Who is it that begins the movement toward marriage? Who is it that plucks the apple off the tree? Now, I do not want to, in making that comparison, in any way denigrate the character of Desdemona before we meet her. Clearly what's going on here is something that makes perfect human sense. She's met a heroic man. She has fallen in love with him. She indeed, being womanly, suggests that, well, you know, if you have a friend who would tell me that story, if you had a friend who wanted to woo me. But notice again, what we have is Othello, who clearly is enraptured by this woman, telling her the whole story and spending this time with her and getting the reaction, but he will not inaugurate the relationship. Why? He's a Moor, and he knows it. He's an outsider, and he knows it. Upon this hint, I spake. She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them. This is the only witchcraft I have used. Here comes the lady. Let her witness it. It's a superb defense. We understand why they fell in love. It's an honest love. There is nothing wrong with it. But what has he left out? The fact that he did not get her father's permission. And we are in Venice. We are in a patriarchy. We are in a civilized society. And the daughter does not marry without the father's permission. So why didn't Othello go to Brabantio and say, Brabantio, I've fallen in love with your daughter. She has fallen in love with me. I am a nobleman. I am a hero. I am an honorable man. Therefore, give me your daughter's hand. Why didn't he do it? Because he knew what the answer would be. No. You're black. I will not have my daughter marry a black man. I will not have my children be half Moorish. No. Therefore, Othello doesn't do the honorable thing. Why doesn't Desdemona go to her father and say, Daddy, I've fallen in love, and I want to marry Othello? Because she knows what the answer will be. The answer will be no. Under no circumstances. Yes, he's a good man. Yes, he's an honorable man. He is not to be your husband. And therefore, knowing the answer, they decide to do what? To circumvent the system, to go outside the established order, to get what they want in another way. This is Shakespeare at his greatest, because everyone who has ever seen the play, all of our hearts are with Desdemona and Othello, because there's nothing wrong with that love. It's a great love. And the way he describes it is magnificent. There's a reason why that passage is repeated over and over. It's one of the great dawnings of love ever described. But the head says, without the father's permission, we've got trouble here. And what Shakespeare does always, and the reason he's a great dramatist, is he creates dramatic tensions, dramatic conflicts that are irresolvable. Should they have gone to the Father? And we say, yes, they should have. They should have gotten the Father's permission. But he wouldn't give it. Oh, therefore should they have waved farewell and never seen each other again? Well, no, they're in love. And it's a great love, and he's a good man, and she's a good woman, and you want her to marry Rodrigo? Blah! So that what do we have? We have these two things. They are irresolvable. You can't work it out. It's not possible. And what happens is what we feel would be nice to happen. They're in love, so it's all right. That's modern. That's modern. Well, love conquers all, doesn't it? As long as they're in love, what does it matter? But Shakespeare is still medieval enough to say, uh-uh, nope. There's order. There's a reason why the Father must give approval. And if the Father doesn't give approval, then we could have trouble here. And he shoves the two things together and they're irresolvable. It's what I call one of his dramatic knots, and we can't untie it. Because our heart knows one thing, our head knows another. Part of the modern part of us is tugging us forward. The medieval part is pulling back, saying, well, no, no, and there's no resolution. But what happens is they act. Notice what the Duke says. I think this tale would win my daughter, too. But, of course, underlying that is, well, that's a great tale. Oh, I understand that. But whew, thank goodness he didn't meet my daughter. Boy, I'm glad I didn't invite him to my house. Good, Brabantio, take up this mangled matter at the best. Brabantio, look, yeah, I admit this. The Duke is honest. We got a real mess here. Brabantio, make the best of it. Men do their broken weapons rather use than their bare hands. You do what you gotta do. And they were in love, so they had, the Duke, what he's really saying is, make the best of it. We need him. And it's not surprising he comes up with a weapon image. Brabantio, I pray you hear her speak. If she confessed that she was half the wooer, destruction on my head if my bad blame light on the man. Come hither, gentle mistress. Do you perceive in all this noble company where most you owe obedience? Here's the woman herself. This is our introduction to Desdemona. Notice the question he's thrown to her. It's loaded. He's tossed a loaded question at her. Notice the response. My noble father, I do perceive here a divided duty. To you I am bound for life and education. My life and education both do learn me how to respect you. You are the lord of duty. I am hitherto your daughter. But here's my husband. And so much duty as my mother showed to you, preferring you before her father, so much I challenge that I may profess due to the Moor, my lord. Good answer, good answer. Okay? Great response. One problem. There's once again something left out. When she says, you're my father, I owe you respect. I owe you respect. A daughter who respects her father doesn't elope without telling him. So she has made the situation now of the double duty. One sense, she's created the problem. But what do these words tell us about this woman? She is not a romantic twit. She is not just headstrong. This is not just pure passion. Those are words of reason, balance. She does still respect her father. She now loves her husband. She's trying to do what? Rebalance a situation that she knows is troublesome, and she does it brilliantly, although she has to omit one detail. What does it mean? We like Desdemona, and we're on her side. You know, the alternative is marry Rodrigo. Notice her father's response. God be with you, I have done. Please, at your grace, onto the state affairs. I had rather to adopt a child than get it. Come hither, Moor. I here do give thee that with all my heart, which, but thou hast already, with all my heart I would keep from thee. Whew, he admits it. If you two had come in and asked me, I would have said, no. He admits it. For your sake, jewel, I am glad at Seoul, I have no other child. By the way, we're setting up an image pattern there. The pearl of great price. For your sake, jewel, I am glad at Seoul, I have no other child. For thy escape would teach me tyranny to hang clogs on them. I have done, my Lord. Notice the Duke's response. Let me speak like yourself and lay a sentence which, as a griser step, may help these lovers. Let me solve this. Let me put it. When remedies are passed, the griefs are ended by seeing the worst which laid on hopes depended. To mourn a mischief that is past and gone is the next way to draw new mischief on. What cannot be preserved when fortune takes, patience her injury a mockery makes. The robbed that smiles steals something from the thief. He robs himself that spends a bootless grief. The Duke lapses into rhymed couplets, gives little platitudes, basically saying, oh yeah, you were robbed from, but smile and be happy. Make the best of it and go on. The very fact that we've lapsed into rhyme for the first time in the play and the sing-song nature of the delivery makes very clear the Duke is just, it won't do, insufficient, and Brabantio throws it right back in his face. So let the Turk of Cyprus us beguile. We lose it not so long as we can smile. Oh! You want to give me rhyming platitudes? I'll give you rhyming platitudes right back. What's happening within the Senate? The Senate's splitting apart. We have one of the senior senators of Venice mocking the Duke. We have the Duke who's refusing to acknowledge we've got a real problem here and just saying, putting a good face on it and saying, smile! Venice is coming apart. And notice where it started. In one house with one relationship. Okay? Now, all of this is put aside because the Turks are on the way. They're coming toward Cyprus. What do we do with Desdemona while the husband goes off to fight? And the Duke says, well, she can stay with her father. Brabantio says, I will not have it so. Othello says, nor I. Desdemona says, nor would I there reside. Wait, excuse me. The husband goes off to fight in a war. Where should the recently married daughter be? At her home, with her parents. We have more disorder. Okay? What would you... She says to the Duke, will you let me speak? What would you, Desdemona? Follow this speech. I'm about line 245 in this text. What would you... What's your solution? What do you want to do? That I love the more to live with him, my downright violence and storm of fortunes may trumpet to the world. She makes an admission. What has she done? A violent act. She does not cover it over. She is being honest. She has eloped against her father's wishes. That is violence. My downright violence and storm of fortunes may trumpet to the world. My heart's subdued even to the very quality of my Lord. I saw Othello's visage in his mind, and to his honors and his valiant parts did I my soul and fortunes consecrate. So that, dear lords, if I be left behind, a moth of peace, and he go to the war, the rights for why I love him are bereft me, and I a heavy interim shall support by his dear absence. Let me go with him. I've already done violence. I'm already in a storm of fortune. I did it because I saw his visage in his mind. Okay? And now let me go with him to the war. I'm sorry, women have no place in war. Women do not go to war. We have a circumstance now in which there's more disorder, and the disorder is now extending beyond Venice to those going off to fight and defend Venice. And the Duke can't say no. I got to send Othello if I hope to win. We've got this mess here. She can't stay with her father. What do you do? Oh, okay. And then Othello pipes up. Let her have your voice. wait a minute, this is the soldier, this is the mercenary, this is the hired hero saying, let me take my wife with me to the battle. No! This is wrong. This is the subversion of established order. The problems are already here. Vouch with me, heaven, I therefore beg it not to please the palate of my appetite, nor to comply with heat, the young effects in me defunct, and proper satisfaction, but to be free and bounteous to her mind. Look, I don't want to take her along just because we're newlyweds. And it's not because I have appetites. It's not to comply with heat. There's not, because I'm old now, I don't have any of those feelings. Come on. There's a beautiful young woman standing before him, his new wife, they were just married, this is their wedding night, and he says, well, I don't feel any of that. Now we know why he's saying that. Because what are the Venetians saying about this black man who's carried off the prize daughter of Venice?
Well, we know why he married her.
Why do we know that? What has Iago said outside her father's house? Okay. Your daughter and the Moor are making the beast with two backs. Rah, rah, rah. So in order to counter this low vision of fleshly lust, the bride and groom are now doing what? Elevating their love to a level of purity. I saw Othello's visage in his mind. This is pure love. This isn't love of the flesh. I'm not interested in him because he's been a heroic warrior and probably looks great. A solid, manly man, unlike those curled darlings of our nation. Oh, that has nothing to do with it. I just saw his visage in my mind. I never looked at him. Never looked at him. He doesn't have a body. Man and wife are one flesh. You start denying that flesh and you're in trouble. And Othello says, oh, no, I don't want her to come along for those reasons. But to be free and bounteous to her mind. Oh, I love him because of his mind. Oh, I love her because of her mind. They're not talking like newlyweds, folks. This is not appropriate language for the wedding night. But it's understandable, okay? And the Duke says, fine, that's great. Why? Solves my problem. The point I am making is that this whole first act is the spreading of disorder. And part of the disorder is that disorder I mentioned at the beginning that's in Iago, the external not matching the internal, to the point where the wedded couple on their marriage night is saying, this is all pure, this is all spiritual, this is all mental. No, that's disorder. This is, again, fragmentation. Man and wife are one flesh. So, off they go together, except, who does Othello trust her to? Because she obviously can't go on his boat. He's going first. He's got his soldiers. So she'll come later on one of the other boats, escorted by Iago. Iago. So please, your grace, my ensign, a man he is of honesty and trust, to his conveyance I assign my wife. Oh, and already the heart breaks. Now, I want you to look at the moment just before the Duke, the senators, and all the officers leave, about line 285, 290. The last words of the Duke to Brabantio before he leaves. Good night to everyone, and noble signor, if virtue no delighted beauty lack, your son-in-law is far more fair than black. If you're going to judge by virtue, this is a good man. This is not a black man. Those are the Duke's last words. Fair enough. We have a heroic man here who's participated in a mistaken action. He has not done a wise thing. But he's a good man. The first senator, a Jew brave Moor, used Desdemona well. Brabantio leaves with this. Look to her more, if thou hast eyes to see. She has deceived her father, and may thee. The play is over. The play is over. The rest of it is working out of those words which fall like a curse. And her father is wise enough to say, I'm not predicting that she will. I don't know if she will or not. All I know is, this wasn't the daughter I knew. She deceived me. If she's willing to deceive her father, then she may deceive her husband. Who's standing on the side listening? Iago. Ding! We see the light bulb go on. Ding! Oh. Yeah. I know how to get him. I know how to get him. Her father leaves, and Othello says, as Brabantio goes, my life upon her faith. Honest Iago, my Desdemona must I leave to thee. I prithee, let thy wife attend on her and bring them after in the best advantage. Come, Desdemona. I have but an hour of love, of worldly matter and direction to spend with thee. We must obey the time. They've just got an hour. They do not have a wedding night. We've got to make preparations. I have to tell you what to do, just, and then we're gone. Exit Othello with Desdemona. Okay? Now, the act began with Roderigo and Iago. It's structured to end with Roderigo and Iago. We get another little scene between the two of them, but everything's changed now. Iago, what sayest thou, noble heart? What will I do, thinkest thou? Will I go to bed and sleep? Roderigo says, I will incontinently drown myself. Now we know what he was whining about at the beginning. He wanted to marry her, and she's run off and married Othello. He's waited all this time trying to marry Desdemona. She's married someone else. I will incontinently drown myself. If thou dost, I shall never love thee after. Why, thou silly gentleman? It is silliness to live when to live is torment. Then we have a prescription to die when death is our physician. Oh, villainous. I've looked upon the world for 4 times 7 years, and since I could distinguish betwixt a benefit and an injury, I never found man that knew how to love himself. Ere I would say I would drown myself for the love of a guinea hen, I would change my humanity with a baboon. Drown yourself for a woman? Are you crazy? Notice the animal imagery. The love of a guinea hen. She's just an animal. Okay? What should I do? I confess it to my shame to be so fond, but it is not in my virtue to amend it. I can't help it. I mean, it's just... And her father said, I wish I had given her to you. We got a problem here. I mean, obviously, our hero is the better man. It's not in my virtue to amend it. Virtue? A fig! 'Tis in ourselves that we are thus or thus. Our bodies are our gardens, to the which our wills are gardeners. So that if we will plant nettles or sow lettuce, set hyssop and weed up thyme, supply it with one gender of herbs or distract it with many, either to have it sterile with idleness or manured with industry, why the power and corrigible authority of this lies in our wills. What directs all my actions and everything I do? My will. What does he say he has directed his will toward? The love of myself. Iago's a modernist. Thoroughgoing modernist. If the balance of our lives had not one scale of reason to poise another of sensuality, the blood and baseness of our natures would conduct us to the most preposterous conclusions. But we have reason to cool our raging motions, our carnal stings or unbidded lusts, whereof I take this that you call love to be a sect or scion. Boy, is he a modernist. Remember the chart that was on the board yesterday? Okay, we've got reason, we've got mind, says Iago, and we've got appetites and lusts, eros. That's all we've got. What's he left out? Heart, thymos, harmony. And indeed, he says, fortunately we're reasonable creatures because we can understand we're also lustful creatures and our reason can control our lusts. That's incomplete. He will not acknowledge such a thing as love exists. He says, you say you're in love. Love is merely a sect or scion of lust. No such thing as love. It's just sort of a romantic, gooey vision of appetite. This is frightening. We again have fragmentation, incompleteness, but we now understand all that animal imagery he's been using. What's his vision of the relationship between Othello and Desdemona? It's lust. They're two animals. They were only fleshly. That's all. It was just flesh. It was just the appetites of the flesh. They're just putting a good name on it. Wait a minute. What is Othello and Desdemona's view of themselves? It's all mind. It's all pure. It's all spirit. We have a ripped apart vision of love. We have fragmented, disjointed, destroyed love. Othello, who's denying it's fleshly, and Iago, who's denying it can be spiritual or of the heart. We begin this play with no sense of real love except perhaps Desdemona, although she's speaking with her husband at this point, trying to put a good face on it. This is a tragedy of love, and in the first act, love is not even anywhere accurately defined. No wonder there's trouble ahead. Rodrigo, God bless him, is still smart enough to deny what Iago says. Whereof I take this that you call love to be a sect or scion. It cannot be, says Rodrigo. This is Shakespeare. This is Shakespeare at his greatest. We have a character who's been a fool through all of Act One, who suddenly does what? Speaks sensibly. No, you can't say that. Love exists, he says. It cannot be. It's more than that. Good. There's a little bit of sense coming from where? Rodrigo, the foolish one. That's Shakespeare. Human beings are complex, mysterious, and don't ever judge anybody too quickly. The next instant, your fool may be speaking sense. The next instant, your wise man may become a fool. That's Shakespeare. It cannot be. It is merely a lust of the blood and a permission of the will. Come, be a man. Drown thyself. Drown cats and blind puppies. Now, this is the moment when the audience sees his nasty side. Oh, he's mean to animals. The animal rights folks would not like Iago at this point. I have professed me thy friend, and I confess me knit to thy deserving with cables of perdurable toughness. Hey, I'm still your friend. I'm on your side. I could never better stead thee than now. You still want her? Now's when I can get her for you. Put money in thy purse. Follow thou the wars. Defeat thy favor with an usurped beard. I say put money in thy purse. It cannot be long that Desdemona should continue her love to the Moor. Put money in thy purse. Nor he his to her. It was a violent commencement in her, and thou shalt see an answerable sequestration. But put money in thy purse. These Moors are changeable in their wills. Fill thy purse with money. The food that to him now is as luscious as locusts shall be to him shortly as bitter as coloquintida. She must change for youth. When she is sated with his body, she will find the errors of her choice. Salacious, lascivious. Therefore, put money in thy purse. If thou wilt needs damn thyself, do it a more delicate way than drowning, make all the money thou canst. If sanctimony and a frail vow betwixt an erring barbarian and super subtle Venetian be not too hard for my wits and all the tribe of hell, thou shalt enjoy her. Look, I can, you think I can't break this up? He's just a barbarian who's made a mistake. And she's a super subtle Venetian. She deceived her own father. I could take care of the two of them. Therefore, for all the tribe of hell, thou shalt enjoy her. Therefore, make money. A pox of drowning thyself, it is clean out of the way. Seek thou rather to be hanged encompassing thy joy than to be drowned and go without her. Okay? Let thou be fast to my hopes if I depend on the issue. Thou art sure of me. Go make money. I have told thee often. I would tell thee again and again. I hate the Moor. My cause is hearted. Thine hath no less reason. Let us be conjunctive in our revenge against him. If thou canst cuckold him, thou dost thyself a pleasure, me a sport. There are many events in the womb of time which will be delivered. Perverse, go provide thy money. We'll have more of this tomorrow. Adieu. Please notice something. And he'll admit it. He's alone. For the first time we get inside him. Thus do I ever make my fool my purse. What's he going to get from this guy? Money. Why are those who take the lowest possible vision of love, why are the sensualists also so obsessed with wealth? Because sensualism is materialism. And materialism is money. And Shakespeare put those two together right here at the beginning in Iago. He is evil. And the evil is a kind of sick materialism. He's going to get all the cash he can, and he's going to get that because that's all there is. There is nothing higher. There is not even higher love. We're all animals performing animal actions in an animal world, in a physical state that is only material reality, and therefore, I might as well get rich. He's a modern man. Iago, God help us, is a modern man. He comes up with the way of doing. I'm jumping to the middle of the soliloquy. I'm about 385, right near the end, about 10 lines before the end of the act. Let me see now, to get his place and to plume up my will in double knavery. Please notice, one reason he's doing this is just to prove he can do it. How, let's see, after some time to abuse Othello's ears that he is too familiar with his wife. That's Cassio. He hath a person and a smooth disposed to be suspected, framed to make women false. The Moor is of a free and open nature that thinks men honest that but seem to be so, and will as tenderly be led by the nose as asses are. I have it. It is engendered. Hell and night must bring this monstrous birth to the world's light. Please notice, we have the wedding night, but what is born on that wedding night is something monstrous, a great evil that will destroy. We'll go on to the rest of the play tomorrow morning. We'll talk. I'll take questions about Act One this afternoon, but also come with Shakespeare questions. We'll talk Shakespeare this afternoon.